Hello and welcome to the Karate Priest Podcast. I'm your host, Father Daniel Duplantis. I'm a martial artist, musician, airman, and a priest of the Diocese of Houma Thibodeau. One of my other passions in life is teaching, especially teaching about the Catholic faith. Catholicism is a very deep faith. Jesus himself told Peter to put out into the deep for a catch. The most significant answers to life's most important questions often lie deep beneath the surface. Many people have questions about their faith. Through this podcast, my aim is to explore these questions and encounter incredible people along the way. Their stories show that God is constantly at work in our lives every single day, sometimes in the ordinary and sometimes in the extraordinary. Some of the topics treated in this podcast may be sensitive or controversial, but their discussion holds the key to truly living as God created us to live, which is to say that He created us to live in authentic freedom, loving Him above all else. Thank you for joining me on this journey of faith, and I hope you enjoy this podcast. Hello and welcome back to the Karate Priest Podcast. I'm joined today by my producer, Todd Fisher, who you have heard from before, as well as a new guest today. We have a very good friend of mine from high school. That's Randy Groh. And Randy's going to introduce herself a little bit shortly as well. But Randy just graduated with her master's degree in the field of psychology from Nicholls State University. And we actually had a little bit of a different plan for this episode originally. But we're taking a bit of a different route. So before I get to that, welcome back to the podcast, Todd, and welcome, Randy.
Hi, Father Dan. Glad to be back.
Randy, how's it going over there?
Oh, I'm good. So I guess I'll tell y'all a little bit about myself so y'all can kind of put a face to the name. But I am currently... Well, I guess I just finished working at a university for the past year as an intern counseling student. So I just graduated, like Father Dan said, with my master's in clinical mental health counseling. So I'm actually currently in the process of getting my license and hopefully getting hired at the university that I've been interning in. But other than that, like my main, I guess you can say, population that I've been working with are college age students. So that would be anywhere between like 17 to 25, because I only saw people in their undergrad. Now, with that being said, there are I guess we call them non-traditional students who are above that age as well. So it was a very wide variety of people that I've worked with. And yeah, I'm looking forward to be a part of this podcast and definitely to see where this career takes me.
Sweet. So originally the plan was to talk a little bit more about like the mental health crisis, especially as regards the COVID pandemic. But we had some recent events that happened this week. And so Todd, you want to fill us in a little bit about that?
Yeah. It's unfortunate that we have to, you know, continue to do these commentary podcasts like this. The last one we did, Father Dan, was on Ukraine, and now we're covering a school shooting, which seems to be all too common of an occurrence in America now. And these shootings in general are awful, but when they involve these little children in elementary school, it seems to be much, much worse. And to kind of give everyone a little bit of a background, this at the time of this recording, which I think comes out this Friday, will only be about 3 days removed from when the shooting happened. It all happened in one classroom, and the statistics right now is that 19 children and two teachers were killed. And the shooter himself was shot by the police, and many other people, police and the shooter's own grandmother, were shot by him. You know, most of those people, I don't think there's anyone that they think is going to die from, you know, being shot at this point, but those children are dead. The entire classroom was murdered. So we thought maybe this would be an interesting discussion to get into from a spiritual perspective and a psychological perspective of what's going on in a situation like this, and maybe how these families are reacting. How do you address the community with things like this, and just our own back and forth. We know as little to the audience. We know as little as probably law enforcement knows right now. So we don't have a lot of details we can give. And certainly, you know, we can't speak to the psychology, the psychopathy of the shooter himself. No one really knows much about him, and he appears to have been a loner. But the facts we do know right now is that the shooter did buy the two assault rifles on the day of his 18th birthday. So just a couple of days ago, he purchased these assault rifles, and he had no problems with his background check. He had no other criminal offenses. He didn't really have many friends. People that did sort of know him knew of him as a loner. He was a dropout from school. And the only thing that was really, I thought that I kind of gleaned from this that was in the media today was a former classmate of the gunman said that Ramos would get severely bullied and made fun of a lot. And was taunted by others for the clothes that he wore, his family's financial situation, and people would actually call him a school shooter and stuff like that was one of the quotes. So not that this is necessarily the making of a monster, but I mean, jumping off just with some of these early things, you know, what's going on with a kid like this? What's happening with a young mind of a 15, 16, 17 year old that's being bullied like this?
Yeah, Randy, I think this is maybe something you can maybe connect some dots for us, because it certainly does sound like with all that, it, not to say it sounds typical, but it sounds like a lot of similar situations we've had with other school shooters in the past, you know, their background, the fact that they're bullied, the fact that maybe they're lacking a sense of peace in their life to the point where they become volatile to the point of committing shootings like this. So what can you connect some of these dots for us as Todd just presented?
So, as Todd said, you know, I really can't speak on the mentality of what was going through, and I know he's 18, but still very much a kid's mind when making this decision, when purchasing those assault rifles. And it's one of those things that so many different things can play a part into why someone does what they do or what they did. And it can be completely different for everyone. You know, what causes me to break will be very different from which each and every one of you that is listening right now causes you to break. So as far as, you know, the childhood and looking at all of those things, one thing that Todd really said that stuck out to me was, you know, other students saying that he looked like a school shooter. I don't want to say that these kids were telling the future, but, you know, when a student is bullied and they don't have many friends, they don't have people to talk to or to go to, and they feel very much alone, it does kind of start or can start to feel as though, well, they already think this is who I am. You know, they can believe this of themselves that, well, why don't I just become this? Because that's what everybody thinks I'm going to do anyways. And although that is very possible not what happened in this situation, it's one of the things that can go into a kid. And being bullied and being able to deal with that without having a support system of good friends. I'm not sure exactly how involved his family was, but it seems as though they were more underprivileged. You know, they didn't have the money to, you know, provide these nice things and good clothes. And kids are cruel. Kids can very much be cruel. So without having, you know, someone on their side in a daily aspect facing these, I guess you can say, demons of being bullied with them, it can very much turn your mind into, well, if no one cares about me, why should I care about anyone else?
Yeah,
you know, I think, oh, oh, go yeah, ahead. Go ahead. I was I was thinking in terms of, you know, the identity construction of young people. The term narcissist is always interesting. I'm not using the term narcissist for the school shooter at all, but I always find the idea of the narcissist is interesting because this was a term that didn't really exist 100 years ago. Like, no one even is sure if narcissist might have been something that started 50 years ago. But I always think it's really interesting in the construction of a narcissist, whether they become a president or they're a cult leader or whatever they might be, wherever they're at in their lot in life, how much of that is constructed by the environment around them that made them into that? Can a narcissist, can you be born that way? Do you just immediately generate that ego and that persona and then everything comes to you as a result of that? Or is society making you into that? And I can't help but wonder if on the micro level of that, that's happening. You know, I was bullied mercilessly in school. I was a huge nerd. Like, I didn't fit in with anyone. I didn't even fit in with the band geeks. No offense there, Father Dan. I know you were a band guy, but right, I wasn't even cool enough for the theater crowd or the band guys. Okay. Like, and it was terrible because there were maybe two or three of us in our little clique of complete outcasts. I used that to fuel my success. That I was beat down so much, I wanted to kind of, you know, get the best of my peers by my success. But I can see where that could easily, I could have been a different guy and I could have taken all that negativity and all of that that I was beat down with and maybe killed myself. And also, you know, I grew up, I'm a product of the 70s. Guns were around everywhere. You grew up learning to shoot guns in Cub Scouts, you know, like that was the thing. And I mean, it wouldn't have been a difficult situation for me if my head was in that place to take a gun to school, you know, like I could see where the skills would have been tipped like that had I not used that to fuel a different type of creativity in myself. So I think that you, a lot of times you are the product of your environment, your economic place, whether you have a friend's base, maybe the geography of where you're at. This is an isolated little town in the middle of Texas. And it's unclear whether he had parental figures around or whether it was just him and his grandmother. I think the FBI is probably building a huge profile on this right now. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I'm rambling on a lot of stuff here, but do you see what I mean about like kind of how the environment can create you in a way?
Yep.
You go, Dan.
Yeah. What I was going to say a while ago was what, you know, I think, you know, kind of like I'm contrasting in my mind two different school shootings. And one was right around the time when I was born was the Columbine shooting, which kind of really, I guess, really defined school shootings for the years to follow. And just to see how like that really just rocked the country. And then, you know, years later, you have the Parkland shooting in Florida, which was just a couple years ago. And to see just like I think some of the dots I'm connecting here are looking at things like the bullying, you know, which I find has gotten substantially worse today because pretty much every kid in a high school, and maybe even to extent middle school, junior high at this point has a smartphone, has social media. And so, you know, whereas most kids when I was in high school, even just a decade ago, didn't have smartphones. It's so prevalent nowadays that the amount of bullying that happens that doesn't often get seen is really what troubles me is to think of how much goes on behind the scenes that parents, teachers, ministers like myself, you know, aren't fully aware of. But, you know, we know that it's happening. It's just we can't see what's there. It really becomes like a hidden but evident danger.
It's the pile-on effect too. You know, in the old days with me, the bullying happened in person. Like that's what it was. There was no, this was pre AOL or anything. And today you have the ability to not only be bullied at school, but the pile-on of everyone on social media that you don't even know, that don't even live in your town, that can pile on to something that you've done that people want to make fun of. So certainly. I also wonder, you know, lack of a spiritual life. We don't know anything about if this kid had any kind of religion at all. But, you know, also part of the ingredients of what makes a person.
Absolutely. And from that aspect, you know, it seems like there's a very prevalent Hispanic community in Uvalde, from what I understand. And so in Hispanic communities, they're usually very religious, and especially just in trends of American Catholicism. Hispanic communities are really keeping alive what we call popular piety. things like just devotions, like praying the rosary, novenas, processions, even, you know, is very much built into their culture. So even something like a quinceañera, a key piece of a quinceañera is the fact that that the girl with her family goes to the church for a special mass and a special blessing. And so usually religion is very much a part of Hispanic cultures. And so I would imagine that, you know, I would imagine that the grandmother was probably very religious.
I'm curious, this question to both of you. Do you think it takes a different type of mind for a person to be able to kill a child versus killing an adult? Seems like a very difficult thing to gun down a seven-year-old, but a lot of them. Do you agree that maybe it is a different type of mind, or is it the same thing as murder, just murder?
Randy, I'll let you take the first shot at that.
Okay. Putting me on the spot here. But the way I look at it is, you know, and Todd brought up a very good point. This was one of the things that I wanted to circle back on, actually, was, are people born good or bad, or are they a product of their environment? And that in itself can be brought back very obviously and fundamentally to counseling and to psychology, simply because our theories that we have. So when you look at our different theories, that's one of the key points of and key things that these theories look at, because basically what you look at is your personal worldview and then how that can relate. Personally, I do not believe that people are born bad. I think people are born mostly good. I think that we are faced with lots of choices and challenges throughout our lives, and that's what makes us who we are today, how we handle those situations. What do we do? In my opinion, and I guess I'm going to talk in a hypothetical. So for me, it would be much easier to kill an adult than it would be a child. And not to say that it takes a twisted mind to kill a child, but I think it's a very big possibility, because I could never even imagine what these parents are going through, what these families are going through. And when you look at children, you see innocence, regardless of the bullying or the, you know, what have these kids really been able to do anything extremely wrong? And as a person who is especially, you know, a school shooter, in a way it's random, you know, why that school. That's something else we don't know. But could these children have really affected his life, like these individual children affected his life with that age gap? So I think that it does take a different kind of mind to be able to do something like that. But I also think that that mind is made by circumstance.
Father Dan, is this evil from the church perspective?
Oh, I would say absolutely. And to kind of, you know, answer the original question, you know, as to, you know, is someone born this way? You know, I would say the answer is no. And because I'm thinking from a theological anthropology perspective, when we look at, and I've talked about natural law theory in previous episodes, especially when it regards self-defense, that, you know, we are born with these primary precepts, the first of which is the preservation of life. So what that means is it is natural for us to want to preserve life as opposed to take it. And so what, to me, this isn't just, you know, the mindset of someone to be able to do this isn't just unnatural. It is contrary to nature. It is completely contrary to our nature to preserve life. You know, our nature is to defend. And so I think, and this is where, you know, there's some philosophies, and I'm trying to remember the philosopher that came up with the term tabula rasa, or the, you know, the idea that we are born with a blank tablet in terms of our mind. I don't believe in that because, again, theologically, you know, we've identified these primary precepts that we're born almost with like a factory presetting to preserve life and to live in community and all these things the natural law theory says. So with that, you know, this is really, I think, the environment or a person's background overriding what is natural to the point where, so I think, you know, I think there's obviously grave evil in this, but at the same time, there's something so disordered that it's able to completely rewire somebody to go not just unnaturally, but again, contrary, to go against their nature to preserve life.
And it's Aristotle that's where that came from in philosophy. Tabula rasa.
I think it was somebody else who must have been like a neo-Aristotelian as well. There's somebody else, I think, more in the medieval period or the Renaissance period who also used tabula rasa.
I also wonder, you know, not just the murder of young children, but also his own family member.
Right.
Very interesting that also happened. So something snapped with this kid, you know, to get him to this place for sure. And he's dead. We'll never know from him what happened. One of the things we were going to talk about in the original episode before this shooting happened, and we wanted to change the topic up, was about COVID. So Texas had pretty strict lockdowns. And I, you know, kind of go back and look at this kid being 15, 16, 17 years old with different degrees of lockdowns. What's going on with a young child like that in that lockdown period? And I know we kind of have isolated some effects of, you know, bullying on young people, things like this, but what have you seen with young people in general and the lockdown and how it affected them? Can you speak to that?
Which one of us?
Either of you?
Ladies first.
Okay. So the majority of what I can speak from about young people is what I've seen in my family. I have not had the honor to work with many, I guess you can say, children. I've worked with plenty of young adults, but especially whenever you're looking at an adult or a child across the board, what COVID presented us with was complete alter of daily routines. You know, there's no normalcy anymore. Being alone, being stuck in home with the very few members of your family that live together, or some people have big families. I had a fairly small one, but you're stuck with these, you know, same people in a house for an unknown, undisclosed amount of time. And then you also are facing, and this plays more with the adults, but it can have an effect on the children too, as financial issues. You know, people weren't able to work. If you weren't, you know, one of these essential workers, they didn't have the funds to pay for everyone to go home and stay home. So money got tight. And then on top of that, you have social isolation. I know in my household, for instance, being stuck in the house with the same people for days on end, tensions rise. You know, now these little bitty things that we never noticed before are blatantly obvious. And now we're argumentative. We are fighting over silly little things that really don't even matter, just to give us something to do. And all of that without having, you know, any type of, I guess you can say, coping skills or self-care in place can drastically affect your mental health. It'll increase your anxiety. It'll increase your depression, which is things that we saw across the board. Was an increase in those two things. There was also an increase in substance abuse because people were thinking, oh, well, you know, if I drink or, you know, do whatever drug it is that you do, well, I'm going to get away from this for a little while. But those are the main things. Yeah, they're coping skills, but they're very negative ones. Because once you come down from that high, once you're sober, we're in the same place. You've solved nothing. So it's very important to find those things that you love to do and to be able to incorporate those in your daily life, even if it is completely altered. Like Dan said earlier, you know, or it may have been Don, maybe both of you, but with the phones, you know, we're able to FaceTime, we're able to call, we're able to talk. And really at this point, any age can do that. So to utilize that and to ensure that they were talking to people would have made a big difference. But a lot of people weren't utilizing those things. Many people were just sitting at home, twiddling our thumbs and waiting for it to pass.
I think one of the things that I noticed with the friends of mine that had, you know, teenage sons and daughters was that a lot of the stuff they expected to have at 15, 16, 17, 18, they didn't get. A lot of them, they couldn't get their driver's licenses because the DMVs were closed. They couldn't go through their proms. They couldn't have their graduations, all that stuff gone. And it really messed with a lot of these young people that they couldn't have gotten any of those things that were traditional, that they've expected, you know, almost their entire lives to be able to go do those things. And
it's really funny that you said that. And I would say simply because, you know, when I was graduating high school, which this was 7 years ago now, it's been a while, but I didn't even want to walk for graduation. You know, I did not even think that was important. I did it because my mom said, "You're walking." And I'm like, "Okay, mom, I guess we're doing this." But to think back now, if I wasn't allowed that choice, even though it was kind of made for me, but if I wasn't, you know, if I was just told, "Oh, well, you don't get that now. Sorry." That's upsetting because, you know, at least before you had that choice. Now that
that's a really interesting point you bring up there, though, because I think in my experience, we always appreciate things more when they're an actual choice. Mm-hmm. You know, because even if you know, we have a choice already made ahead of time, you know, even like in your case with, you know, you didn't exactly want to walk, you know, but the fact that, you know, if a choice would have been taken away from you, this someone says you're just not walking, you know, there's the, I guess this kind of outside imposition of a will. Mm-hmm. Upon yours, you know, and so, yeah. And that's something that I think is very key in a lot of these discussions is the idea that we have free will and we want to exercise that free will. We want to be able to make choices, you know, and that's the thing too, is, you know, when it comes to anything good or bad, you know, we tend to appreciate the choices we get to make. And when something doesn't become a choice, when something becomes a mandate, and we tend to resent that, we tend to want to preserve. That's a natural thing as well, as to preserve our individual autonomy. And I think that's something we're seeing very prevalently in our culture today, is the idea that people want to preserve their autonomy above all else.
And also, you know, Randy, you were talking about people being kind of isolated at home, whether they were with their families or whatnot, the drinking and all of that stuff. You know, in New York, I saw a lot of people that lived alone. Right. So then you have this petri dish of everyone lives on top of everyone on Manhattan Island.
Yeah.
Right? Like everyone's literally stacked on top of each other. And sometimes, you know, you lived alone, but then when the world shut down, you had nowhere to go or no one you could meet. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting thing. This is very true across the country. Of most animal shelters, there were no dogs. During COVID, really? Everyone went out and got dogs because they were alone. Like people that were alone needed someone or something, you know, and they went out, like there were no dogs available at any animal shelters. Like it's really weird. And I think someday someone should probably do a study on this about how there were literally no animals to be found because everyone went out and got pets during COVID. And I think it, you know, has to be tough for a lot of people that are alone, you know, also. But, you know, one thing I was very vocal about, and I've talked about this many times on your podcast, Father Dan, is churches being shut down.
Oh, yeah.
I always deemed it as an essential service, but the churches were shut down. And I don't even know if legally there was a right to shut down churches. I think this is something that'll probably go through the legal system for a really long time. But yeah. Walmart's open, churches closed. Very odd to me. And I think when people can't get their spiritual help they need, because again, a lot of people that might have problems with their families, their own issues internally, you know, and they're looking, they need to get to church once a week, to shut that down, I think is also detrimental. So I think that there's a mental health and a spiritual health to all of this stuff. And maybe you two could kind of discuss that a little bit, the differences in that. People, I always talk about this a lot. I think it's interesting that, you know, I think you should have essential people in your life, right? I think you need a good attorney, you need a good CPA, you need a good priest, you need a good therapist. You got to have all this stuff to be a well-rounded human being, right? Otherwise, if you're left to do your own taxes, be expected to have an audit. You know, if I try to do my own therapy, I'm probably not going to be right. You know, you got to have professionals for this. I'm not going to change my own oil, right?
Yeah.
You get pros. So people tend to go out and seek out a psychologist to have their talk therapy, and they seek out their priest for confession and their spiritual health. Let's talk a little about those dynamics.
Yeah, and that's one of the whole reason why I wanted to have Randy on for this episode, because we were actually both in the same place when the whole pandemic really began. You know, she was in grad school at Nichols already, and I was I had moved in to finish my last semester of seminary at the church on campus at Nichols State University, and then I ended up spending my first 6 months as a priest there. And so Randy and I both kind of saw exactly what happened, at least from the university perspective, with COVID. And you know, and really, you know, from like a church perspective, like you said, you know, it was strange for us because, you know, when the bishop started saying, you know, we can't have public masses anymore, you know, it was strange for us to have to put an iPhone on the altar. This was before we invested, you know, money in actual like recording equipment to live stream. We just had Facebook Live. So we had our smartphones on the altar, you know, and we were doing mass and preaching to an iPhone. And to, you know, to look out into the congregation, there's nobody there, you know, so that was strange. The way we did confessions, you know, we had to think outside the box for everything that we did. You know, we managed to hear confessions. And the way we did that was, again, I was a deacon when the shutdown really happened. But we had the two priests that were there either on the back of the golf cart or with a chair pulled up to the road, that goes by the church on campus. And people would come to confession drive-through style. They'd roll up in their cars, and I was a deacon at the time. I was directing traffic with the car lines and getting to talk to people before they got to the priest for confession to kind of hear like the anxieties they were dealing with. You know, the fact that no one knew at the time what the real ramifications of this pandemic would be. No one knew how severe it was going to be. And so people were nervous. They were fearful. And when we were afraid, I think that does, you know, make us do things we wouldn't normally do for better or for worse. It can make us act out in worse ways. It can make us reach out for things that we realize we do have to, you know, preserve our life and make us make better choices about the way that we live. And so I think from a church perspective, that's what we were seeing. But you're right, to take away people's right to worship in person, that is substantially different from live streaming something, you know? And people said that, people who would watch the masses live streamed and or watch adoration even live stream, you know, when they finally came back, they said they noticed the difference between something that was in person and something that was virtual. Because again, nothing can replace in-person relationship and in-person interactions. And so I think from our perspective, that's what we were seeing at the beginning of this. Randy?
So to take away from that, it's actually kind of crazy how much, I guess you can say, like crossover, like the same kind of things happening in a church setting and in a mental health setting. It kind of shot us into the future as well. We are, I guess you could say future, I don't know. I'm old fashioned. I like the person to person things. But for those that didn't, you know, we very quickly switched to teletherapy. And you know, these businesses like DoxyMe, for instance, because we can't use Zoom because Zoom's not HIPAA approved, which is like our privacy laws. So like I know that we use this program called DoxyMe, and it's not cheap, but you know, we need to follow up with those laws and align to the people's privacies and whatnot. But you know, we really did shoot into all of this that we were not prepared for, doing mass, I guess technically it wasn't necessarily like groups, but mass counseling over something with Zoom. And as you guys can tell, because we're on Zoom right now, I talk a lot with my hands. I'm a very like moving person. I don't.
You and I both, because we're Cajuns. Cajuns walk with their hands.
So it's one of those things that, you know, in order to show like your compassion and like your genuineness and, you know, show that you really care about these people is much harder through a screen than it is on in person. And then, you know, after that, whenever we did start kind of like, I guess you can say going back to slowly allowing us to be out and about and to proceed with normal life, you know, then we have the mask things. So as you guys can also tell, I'm full of facial expressions. That's much more difficult when all I have is my eyes, because that can be interpreted in many different ways, whereas a frown or a smile is not as, mysterious, I guess you can say, or up for debate on what it means. So, you know, we had to be hyper aware of, you know, how we were presenting ourselves, not only over the computer screen, but in person with those masks. Because there's a lot up for discussion when it comes to, okay, well, what does that like wide eye mean? And we don't even notice we're doing it. We just do it. It's natural. At least it is for me. I'm a face and hand talking person. Dan can vouch for that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I'm the same way also. It's funny. I look back at pictures from, you know, when we were really wearing masks in Louisiana, and I could see pictures where like, you can tell I'm making facial expressions behind the mask, because like, I see like myself wide-eyed and things like that. And I'm thinking of one in particular. I'm giving a church tour at the cathedral to a bunch of third graders. And there's a picture of me wearing my mask, and I'm making these really wide eyes. And I'm like, I don't know if I'm shocked at something or if I'm just being enthusiastic about something. Like, I can't get the full meaning of my expression, because all I see is I'm just very wide-eyed, you know? So, oh yeah. Yeah. I make faces very easily.
And it was fun with our clients too, because, you know, we did do a lot of like joking about it, you know, when they first lifted the mask mandate, you know, and now these clients that I've been seeing, you know, for months or a year or however long I was seeing them, you know, it's like, oh, that's what the rest of your face looks like. Like, that's what you, like, I wasn't expecting that. I don't know why that's not what I thought you were going to look like, but it makes a difference. Just seeing this of someone is very different from seeing the whole thing.
Right.
So we did have a lot of fun with that aspect afterwards, but it posed a lot of challenges. And, you know, not everyone does have a computer that they can download, you know, these different programs on or whatever to do counseling. When you're looking at more of, you know, like my grandparents, they don't know how to work their phones, let alone, you know, get on Facebook to enjoy mass, or, you know, figure out how to use these systems to go to therapy. And so they're sitting completely blind to all that. They were completely stripped. Whereas the younger people, you know, we weren't as, I guess you can say, like completely shut off from the world as many older people were, because of our connection with social media, because of our access to being able to use the internet and having that knowledge.
Father Dan, as we get close to toward the end of the episode, I want to ask a couple other things, you know, for both of you. In this little town, in this community that's now lost, 19 members of it.
Yeah.
What's happening from a spiritual perspective, from the churches there? What is the local church doing for its reach out now? And how is it going to address, you know, the concerns of the parents? How could God have this happen? Like, what's the church response to an event like this?
Right. And what was encouraging to see yesterday was so many dioceses, not just dioceses, but the USCCB, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, actually issuing statements of support. Just before we got on to record this episode, I saw that the Holy Father had issued a statement as well. And the biggest thing, you know, I would say one of the most important aspects of this from the church perspective is solidarity, is not just walking with the people affected by this, but actually being able to grieve with them, you know, to be sad for them, you know, and sad with them. Is always important, you know, and, you know, because if we believe that the church is the body of Christ, you know, and we could ask ourselves, like, how is Christ responding to the situation? And we would certainly see him as somebody who not just grieves for people, but grieves with them. And so we see that at the death of his friend Lazarus in the Gospels, it said Jesus wept. You know, this was a friend of his, you know, so it wasn't just Martha and Mary's brother. He considered Lazarus a friend. You know, so for us to be able to, again, empathize with people, to put ourselves in other people's shoes, you know, to be able to grieve with them in terms of, you know, maybe how do you address, this is one of those really existential questions of evil is, you know, how could a good God allow something like this to happen? And that's the question that people always ask, you know, when these situations happen is why would God allow this to happen? And this all comes back to, and we mentioned this previously, was free will. And it's amazing that, you know, in my reflection this morning, I was meditating. I had the little book called Jesus Calling by Sarah Young, which is a little daily devotional. It's become very popular among all kinds of Christians. It's not specifically Catholic. I don't think Sarah Young is actually Catholic herself. But in today's reflection, it says, though I yearn to help, I will not violate your freedom. I stand silently in the background of your mind, waiting for you to remember that I am with you. So that's the words of God saying that, you know, it's free will. And so he gives that to everybody. Again, going back to the idea of choice, the idea of autonomy, you know, that we wouldn't be able to love at all if we were robots, if we had a predetermined will that we were operating out of, you know. So because of the fact that we have free will allows us to make choices, again, for good or for evil. And so you look at before the fall, you know, Adam and Eve had not committed sin yet, but they were capable of to. There was a capacity to choose evil that had not yet been realized, but eventually is, right, in the fall. So they sin, they actually commit the evil. And so that's where we have the sense of free will, the sense of choice, the fact that we were created to not commit evil, but we were created with the capacity to do so. It's not that we were designed to sin, but we were created with the capacity, again, because we were also created with the capacity to love. So the capacity for either one comes from the same source of free will. And so that's what we have to understand. And so from there, we have choices to make. You know, somebody made a choice for evil, a grave choice for evil, great evil. And so from there, you know, we have to realize what choices are we going to make next? You know, what choices are we going to make in terms of who do we blame for this? What choices we make in terms of how do we cope? How do we grieve? You know, this all comes from a sense of choice that we now have to exercise in the wake of this. And so I think one of the church's greatest responsibilities now is to help people make the right constructive choices in the wake of this. It's easy to blame. It's easy to point the finger at somebody or something. But no matter what happens, I think the church now stands in a role to help people choose to grieve, how to grieve well, how to grieve properly. And then at the same time, to help them with how do you move forward? How do we make sure that things like this doesn't happen again? Again, without the finger pointing, without the blame, but starting with our own spheres of influence, starting with our own families, our own relationships. It starts there. We can't control what other people do, but it starts first and foremost with our own actions. So forming people's individual consciences, then helping with those consciences to form good and holy, healthy relationships as well.
Very good. Very good. It's a great response. Randy, from a psychology perspective, if you knew people that were involved in something like this, one of the families, what's your advice to them? Do you tell them to go to church? Do you seek some counseling? Is it just being around your family at this point? What's the first thing you say?
I say yes.
And all the above.
Yeah. And you know, as Dan was talking, you know, thinking of these things, and like you said, you know, people have this necessity to need certain things. We need a good priest. We need a good therapist. We need someone to do our taxes for us because we don't understand how to do that. we need these things, and you know, in my opinion, and this has a lot to do with how, you know, I was raised, is we need people. We need each other. And whether that be, you know, a stranger or your next door neighbor, you know, when something like this happens, it's devastating. And it's not only devastating to those people who are directly involved, but I think it's been obvious with the statements that have been made from so many different people that this has affected everyone in some manner, and we're all sad and we're all upset about it. And, you know, if I knew these families, or if I knew people who were going through this in any shape or form, or have ever gone through this before, I think my biggest recommendation is to be surrounded by people who care about you, who you care about. And that can be both a priest and a therapist. That can be your family, your community, your neighbors. Because by ourselves, you know, it's much harder to heal alone. And I think that we've all seen that very adamantly with our previous experience with this most recent pandemic. Because we were all forced to be alone. And that in itself caused so much pain and so much depression, so much anxiety. So I think banding together and supporting one another is what needs to be done.
Absolutely. I appreciate everyone being able to get together today to talk about this kind of last minute, for sure. Randy, I hope you come back to this show as kind of our resident counselor that we can bring on.
Right? Yeah, for sure. I'd love to have you again. And yeah, definitely. Well, thank you both so much for coming on the show today. And with all that being said, we will see you guys next time.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of The Karate Priest. If you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and like The Karate Priest on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, and subscribe to the YouTube channel. If you're ever in South Louisiana, come visit me at the Cathedral of St. Francis de Sales in Houma. If you have any questions or comments about the show, you can also email me at thekaratepriest@gmail.com. Your questions are welcomed and may be used in future episodes. May the blessing of Almighty God, the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit come down on you and remain with you forever. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for the International Association of Metatomics at metatomics.org, or find us on social media for other unique content.